And we welcome you to this month's Newport Hospital Hour of Health. We get together every first Thursday of the month, talk about important issues about your health and about the folks at Newport Hospital who keep you healthy. And this time around, it's all about infectious disease prevention. Very, very important always in hospital, but of course, we know from experience just how crucial that is. And my guests today are the leader of the Infectious Disease Inpatient Consult Service, Director of Infection Control and Antimicrobial Stewardship at Newport Hospital, Dr. Francine Touzard-Romo. Dr. Francine, nice to have you with us.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Good to talk to you. And the lead infection preventionist, nursing administration at Newport Hospital, Gail Jackson. Gail, nice to have you back with us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And Dr. Touzard-Romo is back with us as well. We spoke during COVID. And look, if we needed a lesson in how infection works, well, we sure lived through it for years and years. And we're coming back to it to a degree. There are some prevention and infection steps that are in place in Newport Hospital, Dr. Francine and Gail. Tell us a little bit about that. There is a mask rule that's in place in the hospital, correct?
Correct. Correct. We have a respiratory viral guidance decision-making table, and when we see an uptick in our respiratory viruses across our community and in the hospital, we move through yellow, red, and green status. So we moved from green to yellow in December when we saw an uptick. And we require masking for all patients, visitors, and employees when in a patient room providing care. So the expectation would be if a nurse goes into a patient room, the visitor should put their mask on. Hopefully the patient would also be able to mask so that we can reduce transmission of respiratory viruses from all of them.
Sure. It only makes sense. And as I say, if we didn't learn anything through what we all went through together, we should really be aware of this. And as Dr. Touzard-Romo points out, it is not a severe level. There is some headroom there so that it's just the way to go and to be cautious. And look, you're in a hospital. So, you know, it is not to be unexpected. I don't know. So, Dr. Touzard-Romo, tell us what constitutes an infection prevention program. I mean, we know why it's important. And we just gave a great example of at least part of an infection prevention program. What else goes into it?
Sure, Bruce. So an infection control program is a program focused on protecting healthcare workers, patients, and basically everyone that comes into a healthcare facility from getting sick. Our goal is to prevent or stop the spread of any infection that can happen in the hospital and provide a safe environment for the patients, for employees, for visitors. That's what we do. And, you know, we see many infections. Obviously, we're at the respiratory season right now. And the most, this is important at this moment during the fall and winter seasons to prevent respiratory infections. But we see a lot of other type of infections, infections of the urine, of catheters, of skin and soft tissue, surgical site infections. So what we do is that we implement different practices from high hygiene to environmental disinfection to guidance of protective equipment and isolation practices to really accomplish this goal and keep everyone safe from any type of infection.
It is so important to keep that in mind. I mean, it's a hospital. There are germs, there are microbes, and you go there to get rid of them, but that's where they're going to be. And we learned about it. You know, it's so interesting to me anyway, Gail Jackson and Dr. Francine Touzard-Romo. When I think back of on a lesson that I learned about microbes and the spread of germs and the prevention programs. I don't think back to COVID, strangely enough. I think back to when my children were born. And I was in there, you know, and we were all gloved up and masked up and gowned up and all of that good stuff. But the practicality of the steps that were taken to make sure that infection didn't get into a particular place, or how particular areas were kept were kept sterile, but then other areas were not. And it just is such a practical thing when you think about it. I guess it's just maybe it was during the pandemic or something that the idea of germ-free and protection from infection and things just became this kind of insurmountable. It's almost like a horror movie, a monster that we have to be afraid of. Is it just me, or did we get to that point at some point?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that happen behind the scenes that maybe people were not aware that they happened until COVID hit, and it became more aware to the general public of what things the hospital puts in place to protect, patients, visitors, staff. But the implementation of these practices have been going on for a long, long time. Is now that it has more of a translated into the community when we have COVID-19 epidemic, that I feel like people are more aware of what we're doing in the hospital to protect others.
That makes sense. We've always
known how germs were transmitted, either by contact with other people or the environment, or through droplets in the air. And we've always known all the methods we need to take to prevent them. But as Francine said, when the community started to realize how easily COVID was being transmitted, they started to become educated about those transmission risks.
Has the education stuck, or do we go back to our old ways?
No, I think definitely we have reset, and there's a much more awareness and mentality overall from the community to be mindful of when they're sick and how often and how common they could potentially transmit to others. I mean, there has been, there's waves of people that might argue against it as people that will favor, but I would say that the pandemic was an opportunity to reset, and the majority of people are now much more aware of how easily certain germs could be transmitted to others and how careful they can be at home or in their own personal practice to prevent those.
That's true. I think one thing that maybe we've learned is to accept that when someone is not well, they really need to keep their distance and keep away from other people to avoid the spread of these things. That's become more accepted, hasn't it?
I believe that it has. And I think for the majority of people in the community, they understand that if they're ill, they should stay home or stay away from people, or if they need to be with people, they should wear a mask. And people around them are as aware as they should be. And
they also understand now the risks of people that are around them that are immunocompromised,
right,
that have some other serious health conditions that might need to be more careful than others. So I do think that people, even without having a Department of Health mandate of masking, you still see people wearing their mask in the supermarkets or places like that because they're aware they're sick, or maybe they have a condition which increases their risk of getting a severe illness. So they're trying to protect themselves and others. So I can certainly see that happening still.
For sure. Now, is the level of is the level of caution that's being practiced in the hospital right now, is it just to mask, or are there other steps that are taken? For example, you mentioned someone who's sick and how it's so accepted that they stay home or stay away from other people. Do you do any type of an evaluation on someone? And if someone appears to be ill, you might advise them in a certain way? Or is that the next level of protection and of caution?
Well, if you're talking about patients that are being admitted, we certainly evaluate them on admission. If they appear to have a respiratory illness, we put them on different levels of isolation precautions so that when they're in a patient room, anyone who goes in that room will wear, potentially, if it's a respiratory viral illness, a gown, gloves, a mask, and eye protection so that they can all be protected from that respiratory virus. Generally, with our yellow status, we're just requiring a mask for everyone. And then we take a different level of precautions when we know there's a specific infectious disease or symptom that we need to protect everyone from.
It's common sense. And these two folks are at the front of the line here. Gail Jackson, lead infection preventionist, Nursing Administration, Newport Hospital, and Dr. Francine Touzard-Romo, who is the director of infection control and antimicrobial stewardship. We're going to talk about that term in a minute. And Dr. Touzard-Romo leads the infectious diseases inpatient consult service at Newport Hospital. It's the Newport Hospital Hour of Health here on FM 101.1 and AM 1540. It's the Newport Hospital Hour of Health. We're talking about infection prevention with the Director of Infection Control and Antimicrobial Stewardship, Dr. Francine Touzard-Romo, and Lead Infection Preventionist, Nursing Administration, Gail Jackson. Can you tell us a little about this antimicrobial stewardship and what it involves?
Sure. This is another program that plays an important role in maintaining patient safety and quality of care. Antibiotics are a wonderful tool, as we know, to fight bacterial infections. However, their overuse and misuse when we use them when they're not needed can increase the risk of other problems, such as antibiotic resistance, toxicities, adverse events related to antibiotic use. So this program, what it does is I work in conjunction with our clinical pharmacist, and we review every day patients that are on antibiotics, and we help providers take decisions about if these antibiotics are actually needed, if they need to be changed, if the dose needs to be optimized, if we can shorten the duration of the antibiotics depending on what we're treating. So it really helps optimize that antibiotic therapy for each patient so we avoid unnecessary exposure to antibiotics when not needed.
It's really kind of tricky, isn't it? Because you have to really guard against the antibiotics losing their effectiveness, right? Or is it that the antibiotics lose their effectiveness, or does the germ become immune to the antibiotic?
Well, the antibiotic resistance, basically the germs are smart. And the longer they're exposed to a drug, they develop mutations or changes that allows that antibiotic to not work or not be effective as it's used to. And then we have issues on treating that same bacteria with the same antibiotics we used to treat them. So then we have to escalate or go up to something much more stronger. We used to use penicillin to treat, the majority of infections, of bacterial infections, staph, et cetera. And as you know, this staph has become resistant to the common penicillin we use, and now we have what we call MRSA, our methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, and we need to recur to other antibiotics to treat the same organism that in the past used to be susceptible to this antibiotic. So, yes, as we use more and more antibiotics, which certainly in sometimes are needed, but in sometimes we want to be cautious of and use the shortest effective duration as possible, and don't take antibiotics just because you know, antibiotics are not effective against viruses. So people at home should not be taking an antibiotic if they are not prescribed it by a physician or required. We shouldn't be taking antibiotics that were left over from a different infection or borrowed from a different person. Because, you know, the reality is that each antibiotic has a spectrum of which bacteria it is. It's not like one antibiotic treats everything. And we have to be mindful of when we need certain antibiotics or an antibiotic we use for urinary tract infection, not necessarily is going to serve for pneumonia, things like that. So it's important that people understand that an antibiotic is not necessarily the answer to make you feel better. It's just needed when it's needed. And that's why they're prescribed.
It's a battle. It really is, and it can be a long-term battle. And then there's also the situation where you have a patient sensitivity to a particular antibiotic. What happens in that case?
Yeah, so, you know, there are certain cases where certainly allergies are true. But in the case, for example, of penicillin, the majority of those allergic people might be labeled as they're allergic to penicillin since they were a child. The majority of people overgrow that allergy and they don't are truly allergic to penicillin anymore. There have been studies with skin testing to prove that they're not truly allergic and they can be exposed in their future life. So it's important to own labeling or asking appropriately, what is the allergy reaction? Sometimes people have side effects like diarrhea, but that not necessarily it's an indication for not exposing them in the future to that antibiotic. So it's important to understand that sometimes these allergy histories are not true, and we can sometimes in a supervised environment, like in the hospital, re-expose them to see if they can take that antibiotic. Having an allergy to something that it's not really an allergy makes us choose broader antibiotics or antibiotics that might be stronger or have other side effects when the best choice is not possible. So, you know, if it's a true allergy, we certainly have other options as well, but it's important to labeling if that allergy is true or not.
Isn't that interesting? What a great thing to consider. And at the right moment, we should kind of take a look at these things. If there's something that's longstanding, take a look and talk to your physician and things like that. So interesting. So the other thing that I wanted to get across is we're talking about antibiotics and we're talking about treatment. That is different from vaccine, correct? I guess the question would be, is it too late to get vaccinated? If you find yourself coming down with this or that, is it too late to get vaccinated? Is there a time when it is too late to get vaccinated? And what's the difference between vaccination and the course of treatment that we talk about with antibiotics?
So yes, as you mentioned, antibiotics are usually taken as treatment for an infection that has already been diagnosed. Vaccines are usually a method to prevent acquiring that disease, or even if you do get the disease, preventing from getting a serious illness from that disease. If talking about the respiratory season, we have influenza, COVID-19, and now RSV vaccination available for this respiratory season, which are the most common viruses that we're seeing. And no, it's not too late to yet vaccinate for the respiratory seasons, even though, you know, we encourage people to vaccinate early, like September, October, which is the beginning of the season. The respiratory season lasts until the end of the winter, and it usually peaks between December and February. So it's not late yet to vaccinate. So we usually continue to vaccinate until the end of March or until we see that the respiratory virus circulating in the community has come down. So I would encourage people still to get vaccinated.
How many vaccines do you have to have? Do you have to have one for flu, one for COVID, one for RSV?
Unfortunately, yes. Mm. We don't have yet a combined vaccine for those viruses. You know, the seasonal influenza. The problem is that influenza virus mutates frequently.
Right.
So every year they have to target to the strains that are circulating in the southern hemisphere, which is where the season starts. So the influenza vaccine at this moment is not yet. They are working on it and potentially making a one single COVID influenza vaccine. But, you know, noting that every change, there's a different variant or circulating strain and it has to be updated. So at this moment, we're kind of lagging behind to make it one single vaccine available for that. And the RSV just came out. So, you know, I'm hoping that for the future, we have that luxury of having one single vaccine, but not yet at this moment.
Now, I guess I had asked the question already. So in terms of flu, if you have not received a flu shot yet, is it still going to do you some good to get one of those at this point?
Yes, I do still feel, you know, the effectiveness of the vaccine, you know, it's more than 50% earlier in the season. You know, we have to know the data later on. But certainly we are starting to see influenza cases. So there's still time to get protected.
So there is still time. So it's don't look too much at the calendar in terms of the seasonality, just because we're heading into February here. What about the others? What about, there is still COVID around, as we talked about, and what about RSV? What is the seasonality for RSV?
Yeah, so, you know, as we see COVID, we see it throughout the year. We don't necessarily see it as a seasonal. You know, we see higher peaks maybe in the respiratory season, but it's throughout the year. The same thing that we've seen sometimes with RSV. So it's important to get vaccinated, particularly if you're a high-risk individual that are elderly or have, you know, heart conditions, kidney issues, other things that can increase your risk of having severe disease. I would encourage that you get vaccinated.
And you can certainly take advantage of a lot of different places to do that. We'll talk about more infection prevention and having a great discussion about that today with Dr. Francine Touzard-Romo, who leads the Infectious Disease Inpatient Consult Service and the Director of Infection Control and Antimicrobial Stewardship, and Gail Jackson, Lead Infection Preventionist, Nursing Administration at Newport Hospital. It's the Newport Hospital Hour of Health here on FM 101.1 and AM 1540. Welcome back. It's the Newport Hospital Hour of Health. First Thursday of the month, we are talking about the important topic of infection prevention with Dr. Francine Touzard-Romo, who is the Director of Infection Control and Antimicrobial Stewardship here at Newport Hospital, and Gail Jackson, RN, Lead Infection Preventionist, Nursing Administration, Newport Hospital. Gail, let's talk about prevention. Let's talk about those things that we had to be taught and told how to do. Washing the hands, masking, disinfecting. Talk about the importance of this, not only in the hospital, but at home as well.
Well, hand hygiene has always been critical to reducing the risk of transmission of any germs. So we all learned to wash our hands before we ate, after we went to the bathroom. But it's critically important in healthcare settings that all staff clean their hands before and after their encounter with any patient to reduce the risk of transmitting those germs from one patient to another patient. It's just as important in the community. And I think for school-age children, I think it's really important that parents educate them early on the importance of hand hygiene when they get home from school, so that they don't bring the germs that they've encountered in school home to the family.
It was an important lesson, and it is such a shame that we had to be taught how to do this, or we had to be commanded to do it. And it took on a life of its own, like everything else in this world and all that. But just the education that we should have gotten about, as you say, where you're exposed to different things in different settings and how you really are in control. And the other thing is that soap and water works much better than the sanitizers.
Well, that's true, that soap and water used correctly for at least 15 to 20 seconds, warm water, soap, and vigorously rubbing your hands is very effective in reducing any germs that are on your hands. You wash them down the drain, soil or germs down the drain. If your hands are not visibly soiled, hand sanitizers do work well.
Oh, good to know. Okay. Because the hand sanitizer's kind of got a little bit of a you know, bad reputation as well. But that's a good little rule of thumb. If your hands don't look dirty, then you might be okay with the sanitizer. But if it's a choice, wash your hands. What about masking? You know, and again, took on a life of its own and all of this other stuff. But the idea is that these microbes and these viruses are spread through the air. We learned that COVID was spread that way and not so much by touch.
That's correct. So any viruses, respiratory viruses, are spread by droplets, both large and small. If someone has a respiratory virus and they wear a mask, those droplets will not get out into the air and therefore will not transmit to someone else. So if the person who's ill has the virus wears a mask, the risk will be reduced. And if the person that's near them is wearing a mask, it'll be even, the reduction will be even lower. So during the height of COVID, asking everyone to wear a mask was helpful in reducing that transmission.
And I just wanted to mention too that, you know, each mask, there's different types of mask and each mask has different types of protection. You know, back in the day when we had shortage of, you know, PPE, there's a lot of cloth masks being used, but, you know, we have surgical masks and we have the N95 mask, which definitely is going to provide a higher level of protection through, you know, smaller droplets and particles in the air that are transmitted, what we call airborne. So it's important to, you know, make sure that we're wearing those masks correctly as well to maximize that protection. But certainly masks offer a way to protect from respiratory viruses or diseases that are transmitted through the air.
What type of mask is being used most often at the hospital these days? Are you giving out masks for people who need them?
Yes. So anyone who comes into our front desk, visitor or patient, is registered, but then they are given a mask to wear. It's called a level 2 mask. If you look on the side of a box, you'll see a 2 on the side and you know it's a level 2, so it has some filtration capabilities. Those patients and visitors are being told right now that we're in yellow status and that they should wear that mask when a provider is providing care to them if they're a patient or when a provider comes into a room that they're visiting in. For our healthcare workers, we wear a level 2 mask, and if a patient has COVID or TB, we have other indications for an N95 mask, but particularly if a patient is COVID positive, we wear an N95 mask. It's a higher filtration and will be more protective for our employees.
Right. What about tests? Is there a time when a visitor, for example, might get a test for COVID? Is there a time when someone might ask for a test for COVID? Are there certain people who are always tested when they come in?
So we don't test visitors for COVID. What we ask of visitors, and we ask the community broadly on this call, is that if they're unwell, that they stay home, they do not come and visit the hospital, because we don't want them to transmit any illness to our patients who are already ill. We do not test visitors. We only test patients, and we test patients if they have respiratory symptoms.
Can a visitor ask for a test?
Not at Newport Hospital. No. What we would ask is that they purchase, and typically insurance covers antigen tests, so they can get some testing free of charge and do a home test, COVID home test.
Right, Right.
If they present to the emergency department and they have a respiratory illness, they would then be a patient and they might get tested.
Gotcha. So it brings up a great question. When should people go to the hospital for an illness, or when should they go instead to their primary care doctor or an urgent care facility, or when is home care enough?
Ruth. So, you know, we have options of going, you know, when we feel ill and we feel like we need medical attention, you know, we can reach out to our primary care doctors, we can go to an urgent care or walk in or go to the emergency room. As a rule of thumb, if you have an illness or symptoms that is something for which you would normally feel comfortable addressing with your primary care doctor, then probably an urgent care or walking is the setting that you want to stay with. If you otherwise, if you have a very severe symptoms that may suggest something serious, for example, an acute chest pain that you're concerned, you have a heart attack, or you just fainted or have new neurological symptoms that suggest you have a stroke, or you just have a severe injury from trauma or a head injury or a serious burn or acute belly pain that might need some type of surgical evaluation, then those things you can go to the emergency room. But we certainly don't want to crowd the emergency rooms with things that are a little bit more trivial and that can be taken care of by either your primary care doctor or an urgent care walking. That's what I would say.
Sure. And it brings up something that we talk about from time to time here in the Newport Hospital Hour of Health, and that is the phenomenon of someone who is kind of using the hospital as a primary care physician. Now, I guess, if you're feeling well and you're not in a critical need right now, now might be the time to establish yourself with a primary care physician. Is there a referral program? Is there some way that the hospital can help with that so that we're not crowding the emergency room?
Certainly, if you don't have a primary care physician and you present to the emergency room, they can send referrals to different or give you options. The best way sometimes is looking at your insurance and see who your insurance covers in a certain area, geographic area that you want to stay. For example, if you're at Newport and you want a specific provider, it's only in the island. But, you know, Lifespan certainly has online. You can certainly look at a list of providers that are from Lifespan or from Brown Physicians as well to look into the different specialties and provider and choose a provider of your choice. But if you come to the emergency room and you don't have a provider, they can help you select a provider and refer you to a provider so they can follow up you in the future. Certainly, having a primary care doctor helps decrease those unnecessary emergency room visits. And you can, most primary care doctors have like urgent visits or that they can book you for a sick visit if you need to see one. So certainly those are better options that come to the emergency room for any little thing.
Yes, without a doubt. And you bring up a great point. Lifespan is such a tremendous resource. There are so many places that are available to you and so many resources that are available to you through Lifespan. But as we usually work in on every episode here of the Newport Hospital Hour of Health, you can find someone who will care for you and you won't have to leave the island. You won't have to even leave Newport. There's no doctor shortage right now. You can find yourself a doctor, and Lifespan is more than able to help you with some resources there. And it starts at lifespan.org or newporthospital.org as well. So a great bit of advice here in the midst of our discussion on infection prevention with Dr. Francine Touzard-Romo, who is the Director of Infection Control and Antimicrobial Stewardship at Newport Hospital. She leads the Infectious Diseases Inpatient Consult Service. And Gail Jackson, RN, Lead Infection Preventionist, Nursing Administration, Newport Hospital, here in today's Newport Hospital Hour of Health. The Newport Hospital Hour of Health, and today we're talking about infection prevention with the Director of Infection Control and Antimicrobial Stewardship at Newport Hospital, Dr. Francine Touzard-Romo, and with Gail Jackson, RN. She is the lead infection preventionist, Nursing Administration, Newport Hospital. So we've been talking about germs, and the germs come home so often with the kids, and lots of people have kids, and the kids have all sorts of germs, and it was ever thus. So Dr. Touzard-Romo, Gail, what can we learn, and what are some ways that we can teach the children to protect themselves and us from infections and seasonal illness?
Well, so we discussed hand hygiene earlier, and I would say as soon as a child is able to stand up on a stool in front of the sink, they should be taught how to correctly wash their hands with soap and water. And with that comes when they should wash their hands with soap and water. When we discuss school-age children, when they get home from school is a critical time to have them wash their hands with soap and water, to wash off all the germs that they accumulated while they were in school, before they eat, after they use the bathroom, as we all learned when we were younger. Another way to reduce the risk of spreading germs, and children should be taught very early on, is that if they're coughing or sneezing, they should cough or sneeze into their elbow. I think that adults, so for me, I'm not elderly yet, but I'm heading in that direction. I was taught to cough into my hand.
Yes.
And if you cough into your hand and reach out and open the door, you're going to contaminate the doorknob with all of your germs. So children are being taught to grab their elbow, pull it into their face, and cough or sneeze into their elbow, and that needs to continue.
Right. It was dramatically shown how viruses and how microbes can spread. I forget what the material was, but there was some demonstration. It wasn't even an experiment. It was a demonstration where someone sprayed some type of a substance. It turned out blue after it had been in contact with skin. And the idea was, just like you described, you know, we were taught once upon a time, cover your mouth when you cough, and you cough into your hand, and then, right, you grab the thing. So the spray, whatever it was sprayed on the hand, and then after a minute or two, the person would grab a doorknob, put their hand on a table, pick up a spoon, pick up a cup, and you would see, maybe there was a light that shone on it, but I don't think there was.
Yeah.
You would see, here is this blue that was left on this doorknob and on this handle by you touching things. And you start to realize just how many things you touch in the course of a very, very few minutes, or going through your day, or going through your routine.
Right. I have done education in classrooms, and I'm always willing to do it again. The product that I use is called Glow Germ. It's a lotion or a powder that glows under a black light. And I have children, one child put it on their hands, it's like a lotion, and I explain very clearly this is pretend germs, not real germs.
Yeah.
And they shake each other's hands. Someone comes over and shakes their hand, goes and touches a doorknob. You know, I just have them go through the classroom, and then I have them put their hands under a black light so they can see that the one person, one child who had this product on their hands, how quickly they were able to spread that germ to all the other children, or many of the other children in the classroom.
Yeah, wasn't
it very effective? It's
dramatic. It really is. Wasn't the space of time, it was like 2 minutes or 4 minutes, that it just spread through the entire classroom?
Yeah.
Yeah, it depends on the germ. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, what is the, you know, the attack rate of the germ,
sure,
that really is going to, how quickly it's going to spread to others. But in addition to, it's important, and now people are more aware of this, not to send their children to school if they're sick and keep them home. And, you know, they can certainly do rapid testing for COVID at home, but it's not just COVID. It's any respiratory illness, as COVID can spread through, you know, through the air. And they have to be cautious of sending their kids to school if they're sick, and they might be at risk of transmitting to others.
Well,
so
sure.
That's important.
You're so right. I mean, COVID got the big reputation, and of course it was a pandemic and so forth and on. But, you know, the cold and the flu can do some damage. And there was an outbreak of both of those in a lot of different places. A lot of people listening to our conversation here are saying, oh, yeah, you know, we all had a cold in December, or we just are all getting over a cold and whatever. And, you know, you tested negative and all of that stuff, but the cold and the flu can still do a job on you. So you need to respect those as well, for sure. Another point that I'd like to bring up, Dr. Toussard Romo and Gail Jackson, is that family members who might be immunocompromised, Doctor, you had touched on it a little bit earlier in the program, but it really is important for all family members, particularly the children, to be aware that there may be someone in the family who has an issue of being immunocompromised. Just talk about that and what steps need to be taken, what education needs to be put across to the kids about this.
Yeah, I mean, certainly might be mindful about this other relative that either is receiving chemotherapy or is in a medication that is actively affecting their immune system, and it's certainly at higher risk than others. So, you know, maybe limit visitation to children, because, you know, sometimes they might not show symptoms of their disease even a day or after. I'm not saying, obviously, if there's grandma, grandpa, not that they cannot visit, but they should be aware that they should be a little bit more careful when really hugging, kissing, or close contact with those individuals, because there might be, you know, not that they want to get them sick, but unfortunately, that are high risk. So making sure that they, you know, wash their hands around them more frequently. And, you know, if they need to wear a mask, they can certainly wear a mask. But, you know, this particular people that are immunocompromised, when they're a certain period of their immunosuppression, they can certainly isolate themselves in a certain way, so they're not exposed to many people or germs around, or being in public places where, you know, anyone can spread disease. That's something that they have to be careful about.
Yes. And to our credit, the lesson has finally been learned, and you'll many times or sometimes come in contact with someone, or you'll see someone and they'll say, oh, I can't, you know, shake your hand or give you a hug because I'm just getting over this, or I had that. And everyone understands. And you're really doing the kindest thing and the most considerate thing that you can do for your family member on either side, whether it's the person who has the issue or whether it's just someone you don't want to catch something.
Exactly.
For sure. So, Gail Jackson, Dr. Francine Toussard Romo, who's been with the hospital the longest?
That would be me.
Gail.
I actually graduated from Salve in 1980, and after leaving town for quite a few years, I came back in 1987. So I've been here since 1987, first on the IV team, and started infection control in 1994.
Wow. And Dr. Francine Toussard Romo, when did you come on board?
I came to Newport in 2016 is when I started. I'm originally from Panama City, Panama, in Central America. And
wow.
I've been in the U.S. Since 2006 when I came for training. And then I ended up in Rhode Island in 2012. And that's when I took the job in 2016. After I completed all my training, and I've been here since with working together with Gail.
Well, there you go. And it's wonderful to talk to both of you. We really appreciate you being here to discuss this topic with us here in the height of the cold and flu season. Of course, the infection prevention, as we've been talking about all during today's episode, it's become so much more crucial. We know so much more about it now and how important it is to us staying safe and healthy. Not just during this season, the infection season, as you point out, but year-round. So I want to thank you very, very much for being with us. Gail Jackson, RN, Lead Infection Preventionist, Nursing Administration, Newport Hospital. Thanks very, very much, Gail.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Francine Toussard Romo, who is the Director of Infection Control and Antimicrobial Stewardship in Newport Hospital and leads the Infectious Diseases Inpatient Consult Service. Dr. Tuzard Romo, all the best to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And today's episode of the Newport Hospital Hour of Health here on WADK AM and FM, and also available on our podcast page at WADK.com under Newport Hospital Hour of Health.